The Difficult Wheel and the Real Weather, award-winning poetry from Betty Adcock and Kathleen Aguero, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Welcome to a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. Although professional poetry in the United States has pretty much retreated to the universities, like the novel, poetry is far from breathing its last. The evidence for this vitality takes many forms these days, from storefront workshops and small publishing coteries to poetry slams and the revival of coffee shop versifying. Listen now for Readings and Conversation featuring two award-winning poets active on the contemporary scene. First on Soundings this week, you'll hear from Betty Adcock, a writer in residence at Meredith College in Raleigh, North Carolina. After that, poet and anthologist Kathleen Aguero will be here to read from and talk about her work. Betty Adcock has published 4 collections of poetry. Her latest is The Difficult Wheel, poems about time, vanishings, and human response to change. Last spring, The Difficult Wheel was awarded the Texas Institute of Letters Prize. With a selection from her new collection of poetry, here is Betty Adcock.
An Associated Press item a while back stated, quote, "An Australian sound engineer has developed a unique way of clearing the hiss and clatter out of vintage jazz recordings," end quote. With that as epigraph, here is my poem, Time After Time. Time, it does things out there among the galaxies. Clatter and hiss? Perhaps. That's one metaphor for distance, which is time. And our remembering? There's less and less. The dissonance of now and then no longer audible when mechanics cancels difference. So out with the scritch of decades, the sizzle and scar of era, remembrances waver, susurrus of mortality, dust rift, blues ether. We will turn them into us, our sound loud as a spotlight, bright as an electronic toy, cleansed of those troublesome 60 years and that old distortion, joy.
Betty, welcome back to the National Humanities Center.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Congratulations on The Difficult Wheel. What made you into a poet? Is that waking up one day as a little kid and saying, well, I'm going to be a poet? How did that work?
Well, as a little kid, I woke up a lot of times and did a lot of scribbling. I'm not sure why I think most children do this, as a matter of fact. And William Stafford used to say, when people ask him, why did you become a poet, or why did you continue writing poetry, he will always say, why did you stop? So, you know, I think that there is a kind of natural thing about this. I think some children are naturally more introspective than others, and I was an only child, and I'd lost my mother early, and I think I turned inward a little more than some children do.
Right.
And I love to read, always. I mean, language fascinated me from the time I can remember. I loved reading things whether I could understand them or not. I just liked the sound of the words.
What about the argument that everybody's a poet? For example, you know, you go to poetry slams, and I sit down and I scribble something on the back of an envelope, and I stand up and read it. Does that make it poetry? How do you land on that?
I land firmly on the side of the angels, I guess.
You got to
work
at it.
That is of those that, you have to earn it.
Right.
I think it does take more than that. Mm-hmm. There's no harm, I suppose, in people doing this. But the fact is that poetry is, as Howard Nemiroff said once, getting something right mm-hmm. in language. And like getting something right in anything, that's very hard to do.
Is there, when you look at your poetry, Betty, is there a way to characterize in general terms, a couple of days, a couple of weeks, a couple of months before you, in Mr. Nemiroff's terms, get it right? Or is that something that just, it's an unsettled issue for you?
It varies tremendously from poem to poem. There are poems that I have worked on for as long as 10 years. I mean, this doesn't mean I'm working on them all the time, of course, right. But that I would turn to and don't get right and put away knowing that for some reason I'm not getting it. And we'll pull it out again several years later, try again, and sometimes I'm successful. Sometimes I'm never successful.
How do you know when it's right? Is that something? Is there a voice inside of you, or is that the critic's work? Is that something that happens between you and the people that you confide in, who are known personally to you? Or?
I try not to think about critics, but in any terms. But I'm listening to my own poems. Right. I suppose pretending to be the reader, the audience. I mumble a lot when I write. I read my poems out loud to myself as I'm working on them. And when it starts to feel right to me, then I let it cool a few days, go back to it. The chances are I'll change one word, two, three.
Right.
Those tiny fine-tuning things that take a little while, and then it's gone. And I know poets who will actually revise poems after they've come out in books. I've never done that. Mm-hmm. I have a sense of... once that's done, that's over.
I love the cooking metaphor. You're going to let it cool for a few days. Betty, what is the life of the poet like in our American mass culture in the 1990s? Do we deserve our poets? I mean, if we take them seriously, they are people who think deeply, and it's hard work. What an honest to gosh poet does, and yet our country seems we got lots of people who call themselves poet, and yet we seem to neglect poetry as a cultural force. What about this?
We live in a society and an age in which there's no conceivable use for poetry, really, and no real wish for it.
Right.
That we need it, I think, goes without saying. Who was it? Williams, who said that you can't get the news from poetry, yet people die every day from want of what is to be found there.
Yeah. Adrienne Rich has a collection of essays with that very title.
What is to be found there, exactly. Right. But you can't tell that to people parked in front of CNN. If they rise from the couch or the computer console vaguely inconsolable and not knowing why, they are still unlikely to turn to poetry, even the educated in this culture. So I think I would have to say that some of this may be because poetry has become a specialty.
Mm-hmm. Like so much else in modern life.
Like so much else in modern life. A very minor, very particular specialty under the protection of the university. But I think that poets don't contribute in any kind of quantifiable way generally. I mean, this is
like asking what good is art.
Yes, it is. I mean, we can't place a number value on this. And that really frustrates Americans because we want a number value on everything.
Oh, yes,
we
indeed.
Really do. We want it down to the decimal.
Uh-huh.
And you can't do that with poetry. It really is something people die for the lack of. And it is more than words, though it is always in words.
Should I take that to mean that you are, what, ever so slightly pessimistic in the advice you would give to the next generation of poets, the people who are going to come along and move out of the kiddie scribbling and through the poetry slams into the life of the real hard work of the poet? What do you say to these next poets?
Well, I have said to people who have talked to me about this that you do it because you love it and because you can't help it. Otherwise, quit.
Fair enough. What is it that inspires particular poems in you, Betty? Let's come back. We've been talking about poetry in our mass culture. Let's come back before we hear you read another poem here. What is it that turns you on and says, aha, here's a poem. There's something I want to write about.
Oh, it can be something as simple as a little article in the newspaper, which I used as an epigraph for that poem that set me thinking, to a recurring memory or a dream or something that happened long ago that I've never been able to write about. One nice thing about getting older is that you get enough, aesthetic distance
right.
from certain things that you can look at them objectively enough to make art out of them.
Uh-huh.
But I was at the beach this weekend and saw a perfectly wonderful photograph in one of the fishing piers. It seems that last June 4th, a black bear, walked out of the dunes and stood on the beach looking out to sea. And here is a snapshot of him taken about from about 15 feet away. And beyond him are these sunbathers, and they haven't seen him. And it's an unbelievable picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would love to be able to write something about that. I probably can't. But that sort of thing sometimes starts a poem. And sometimes it's simply a turn of phrase, a set of words that pops into my head, and I do not know why. So you follow all the leads, and some of them pan out and some of them don't.
Benny Adcock is the author of The Difficult Wheel, a collection of poems available from Louisiana State University Press. Her previous books include collections entitled Walking Out, Nettles, and Beholdings. Betty Adcock is Keenan Writer in Residence at Meredith College in Raleigh, North Carolina. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. With another selection from The Difficult Wheel, here again is Betty Adcock.
This is a poem about time, about photography as well, and about memory. It's called At the Age When You Get Bad News. Letting go of the future is like this, trying to fit back into the camera's aperture before it closed that little square of time. In this snapshot, I am 15, all opening before me. I squint hard against such brightness. Perhaps I feared the shutter's snicker. Memory adds to what's outside the frame. That fence, all rough-barked wood, where my grandfather hung the dead rattlesnake that wouldn't stay dead. That fence, and the field beyond it, overgrown, one slightly agitated cow heading for a shade tree. But all that's beyond the picture's reach. Here I am, feckless and posing. My father stands beside me with his stick. He's looking down, so there's no face to him, just hat with the brim turned down. I'm wearing the sweater of pale lavender that seemed made for someone prettier, like the deep purple skirt of corduroy soft as velvet. It's all gray in this black and white, the colors I'll get where I'm going. In the picture, I'm sitting on my heels, hugging the cur named Red my father kept for squirrels. And some of those in the out-of-focus trees, making the big dog's head begin its easy swing toward joy, just as I am turning already toward the path to this day 2,000 miles away that has brought me another death and this kind of travel. I do manage to get there before the picture, where it's darker than it ever gets until you've traveled afterward yourself. Nobody's looked yet through the finder, the lens not set, boundaries of white paper not yet interrupting a translated sun. I don't know what's going to happen all over again at the speed of light. The trees, my father, the blank sweater, that dog starting to run.
Poet Betty Adcock reading from her new collection, The Difficult Wheel. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Contemporary American Poetry continues now with the award-winning verse of Kathleen Aguero. Her first book, Thirsty Day, appeared in 1977. With Marie Harris, she's the editor of A Gift of Tongues, a collection of essays on contemporary poetry, and An Ear to the Ground, a companion anthology of poems, both published by the University of Georgia Press. Kathleen Aguero's most recent book is The Real Weather, a collection of poems that ranges topically from nature, youth, and the body to poems about the power of human memory. With a selection from The Real Weather, here is Kathleen Aguero.
Beating Up Billy Murphy in Fifth Grade. This poem is, unfortunately, I guess, based on a true experience of mine. Who knows how it started? We were the same age, but he was smaller, with wrists you could snap like green beans, veins that showed blue runners through his skin. His scalp was like something dead beneath his crew cut, and I hated his pipsqueak voice, his hanging around with us girls. Then, somehow, he was face down on the pavement, my fists banging his back. When my girlfriends pulled me off, he whined like a toy engine. I had hurt his sunburn. I would pay if he went to the doctor. He was an orphan I thought I should be nice to. His aunt planned to send him to military school. I was ashamed, but still sickened, remembering his soft hands, his thin eyelashes, the schoolgirl in him.
Let's talk, Kathy, about the work of the poet. There's no contradiction for you, for example, in writing about thinking of yourself seriously now as a poet, and yet writing about a memory of beating up another kid in the fifth grade. How about
no,
that?
None at all. I mean, I think that I guess I'm a sort of populist in my politics and in my writing, and certainly for me it was a great relief and comfort to find these things written about. Mm-hmm. Not to dismiss the larger works, but I think poetry has room for all concerns. Mm-hmm.
You said that your kids got a real big kick out
of
it.
Yeah, they said, way to go, Mom.
Again, Kathy, let's talk about the work of the poet from the standpoint of how you connect with the popular culture and how you connect with the tradition. Is there a contradiction there, or is that, in your mind, a kind of a continuity, an inspiration for you? You know, that which is not poetic in our mass culture in the United States in the 1990s, and yet you living the life of the serious writer and poet.
Well, I think there is both a contradiction and a continuity, if that makes any sense. I think there is a tension in trying to be a writer. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of support for writing, and we have to go out and make our living. And there's still a sort of very rarefied notion of the poet. On the other hand, I see a great upsurge of interest in poetry. Things like poetry slams, I've been to a couple, and they're actually very vitalizing experiences, that people will get up and read something that they wrote a few hours or a few minutes ago, that it has a great deal of meaning for them, that they believe it mm-hmm. has the power to change their lives. I find very exciting and very sustaining when I have to go back to my desk by myself and write.
But to be contentious for a moment, Kathy, is it poetry? Somebody sits down and scribbles something on the back of an envelope, a paper bag, stands up and reads it at a poetry slam, and everybody applauds. Does the poem live just for that moment? How does it become part of this large, again, noble, literary conception that we have of the poet?
Well, it may not be lasting poetry. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I myself as a poet have pretensions and don't want to write poetry that only lasts a minute. I'd like to think of myself as at least aspiring to writing lasting poetry. Nevertheless, I think the interest in language, the feeling that poetry can do something, can change people, provides a wonderful rich context for the poetry that will rise to the top and become lasting. Uh-huh. You need to have some connection to people. And I think that this interest in poetry, whether or not the poems themselves last, can only do good to writing.
When we talk, for instance, Kathy, about gay and lesbian poetry or the poetry of Native Americans, is this an artistic echo or analog of the politics of our culture? Here are people who have been on the outside, and now they're, what, expressing themselves from the inside. Nevertheless, is it poetry, or is it a form of group therapy that we're talking about?
Well,
here?
I'm sure some of it is group therapy, uh-huh. but I also think that some of it is poetry, and that our notion of poetry has to change. I don't think we have to cast out the old, mm-hmm. But I think we have to make room for other kinds of voices, and that they're there, that we can't simply insist on ignoring them. Mm-hmm. I think I leave it to time, in a way, to see what will last. And I'm not saying that all of it is good poetry, but there are people writing very traditional kinds of poetry who are not writing good poetry either.
Is it a question of getting published? After a fashion, what you're talking about here is the reshaping of what's called the cultural canon. Mm-hmm. Is it a question of getting into print? If I see my name above several lines here, then all of a sudden I'm doing something to reshape the tradition. Is that how it works?
I think it's a little more complicated than that. I mean, our first book, A Gift of Tongues, was a book of critical essays about poetry, because what we felt was that we needed to learn how to evaluate work coming from other traditions, how to hear it. I always remember myself listening to Ravi Shankar for the first time, mm-hmm. and not being able to make any sense out of his music because I kept listening for the melody. And until I learned to let go of that, I wasn't able to hear his music. When I could begin to hear it and appreciate some of its beauty. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for poetry as well. Because language belongs to all of us, we tend to have a very proprietary feeling about it. Nevertheless, I think we need to learn how to listen to this new writing and how to evaluate it. I'm not saying there's no evaluation involved.
Mm-hmm. We shouldn't become uncritical.
No, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But we can't apply old standards all the time to new work. I also think there's very interesting things going on with language itself. If you look at, say, Chicano poets who write in Spanish and English, or what they call Spanglish, our language is changing. It's not static. Uh-huh. And I think that looking at multicultural poetry can give us a sense of language as a living, changing thing, not something as fixed.
What about the artistic dimension? Before our taping session, Kathy, we were joking about, you know, memorizing all the rules and regulations of poetry and figuring out the number of metric feet in a line.
Writing in meter and rhyme is very, very difficult work, technically, and I certainly appreciate it. A lot of my students aren't necessary. It's difficult there. It's hard for them to do that. They don't write their best work in that form. And so I tend to stress the ear, hearing the poem in your head, reading out loud, all kinds of work to try to find where its music lies.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's possible, Kathy, to teach poetry in the sense that you can make kids into poets? Or is it kind of an educational episode that they will go through? They can go home and say, Mom, Dad says, what'd you do today in school? Well, I wrote a poem. Okay, so they drop it, they go on to other things. How should it function in our education if it's not just a kind of an isolated thing that mm-hmm. happens to a kid?
Well, it's interesting. You know, people don't ask that about art and music. And I don't see why poetry is considered something different. Can we teach children to be musicians? Well, maybe we can't teach them to be great musicians, but we can teach them something about music. We can teach them how to listen and how to hear it. Mm-hmm. The same thing with art. And so I feel that's true of poetry, too. There's a number of levels on which teaching poetry functions. You're teaching people to be an audience, for one thing. What better way to learn how a poem is put together than by attempting to write one yourself? You are giving them voice, although that sounds sort of corny and verging mm-hmm. toward the art therapy, but I still think it's important. And then there are those students who are going to make a serious commitment to language, and you're giving them a starting point and support and encouragement. So I certainly don't see myself as teaching people to be poets,
right.
But I see myself as introducing them to that world and then trying to help them find wherever their niche is in that.
Who is your ideal reader, Kathy, just very quickly? What kind of an image comes to mind when I ask you that?
That's a really hard question. I guess I'd like to please two readers. One is the critical other poet, who of course we always aspire to please. But the other, I think, is the people of the family I came from, a sort of lower middle class family, not a very wealthy family, not a well educated in some senses family, but absolutely my mother was devoted to poetry and read to me from the anthologies, certainly those traditional poems that had some emotional resonance, maybe poems we wouldn't think of as great art, but poems that meant something to her. And so I'd never want to leave those readers behind, those people in my family who brought me up, who introduced me to writing and who said, well, we don't know what you're doing, but we give you our blessing as we do it. And so in some sense, I'm not saying that I want to write Hallmark verse or anything simple, but I also think we do the general reader an injustice when we think that's all that they can understand or all that they can be moved by. So I guess I have two ideal readers at opposite poles, and maybe I drive myself crazy trying to please them both.
Kathleen Aguero is the author of two collections of poems, Thirsty Day and The Real Weather. With Marie Harris, she's the editor of An Ear to the Ground, an anthology of contemporary American poetry, and A Gift of Tongues, a collection of critical essays about poetry today. Those books, along with her anthology of essays about multiculturalism, Daily Fare, are available from the University of Georgia Press. Reading the title poem from her most recent book of poetry, The Real Weather, here again is Kathleen Aguero.
Barometer rising. Summer, when the sun is strongest, the shades in our apartment are drawn against the heat. We sit in shadow, the rooms more glum than winter afternoons. We mark seasons, changing clothes, plugging in fans or heaters, regulating thermostats. And so with one another, I measure you just so much room in my existence. You spoon me so much pleasure, then no more. Carefully we place ourselves here, there, taking turns being background, foreground, testing the mutual temperature, eyes trained on each other, not wanting to lag behind, not daring to be the first to yield to longing, talk out of turn, in fact, grab it all, knock down walls, hit the roof, break doors, blow up the furnace, smash the thermostat, hurl the air conditioner out the window, and let the real weather in.
Poet Kathleen Aguero. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light. We keep the lights on and more. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 820. That's $10, program number 820. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. If you'd like to have more information about the National Humanities Center, write to us or call during business hours Eastern Time. Our phone number is 919-549-0661. That's area code 919-549-0661. Next week on Soundings, Writing the Southwest, literary scholar and radio producer David Dunaway of the University of New Mexico will be here with excerpts and discussion about his new book and radio series, Writing the Southwest. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.